compelling true stories. The description reads, the scope of nonfiction in comics is now broadened into a far larger realm, from autobiography to journalism, documentary, historic fiction, and education comics. Come listen to creators talk about their nonfictional work and its places and its place within the comics medium. So I remember going to a Scott McCloud talk once, an awesome nonfiction cartoonist, who said that he was on an airplane and he picked up that emergency pamphlet that tells you how to get off the plane, and he realized that it was comics. And that it meant that when your life is on the line, you want comics as the medium to tell
you. And you have uniformed representatives of large corporations asking you to read the comics prior to liftoff.
So, comics rule is the lesson. All right, so we have quite the full panel here, and a lot of stuff to talk about. So I thought we'd just start with one of those go-down-the-row ones where you could introduce yourself and tell about your book or your latest book in some of your cases, and then we can go from there. David, you want to start?
Yeah, okay. My new book is Collier's Popular Press, and I just finished that yesterday. But no, this is my new book, Chimo, and it's about my experiences with the military. And,
Seconds.
I had two experiences with the military, once in the regular force as a combat engineer, and then, after 15 years out, the Canadian Forces Artist Program started. That's a kind of war artist program. And as a civilian, I joined that, and then I rejoined the military as a reservist. And this book is about the whole experience. So it's a long introduction.
That's fantastic. Hi, my name's Tori. I hope you can hear me.
I think your mic's on.
It says it's on,
but it's lying.
How about this one?
Oh, okay. Hello. Is this my voice? Oh, okay. Am I in stereo? Amazing. That was pretty incredible. If I do say so myself. My name's Tori. I wrote an autobiography book called Mirror Mind about my experiences growing up with a learning disability, specifically dyslexia. And I had a thought and it was going to be amazing, and I hope everybody just thinks that was going to be great. So yes, that is me. Okay, fine.
I don't know. Hi, I'm Jim Ottaviani, and I write nonfiction comics about scientists. And is Gina in the room? Is she there? No, she left. So good, because she's going to kill me because I didn't bring a copy of the latest book with me, although it's over at my table, even though that doesn't come out until August, which is sort of weird. But anyway, I've written 8 or 9 books at this point about scientists. The latest is about Richard Feynman, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist, the bongo player, the gallery artist, the guy who worked on the Manhattan Project, the guy who figured out why the Space Shuttle Challenger blew up on live network TV. He was a fabulous storyteller. He did a lot of his physics in go-go bars, and he almost but not quite got to Tuva, an unknown country in Inner Mongolia. And as you can imagine, he's a perfect subject for comic books. So that's what I did. That's what we did, I should say. The artist on it is Leland Murek. But I've done a whole bunch of other books, too. But that's old news.
My name is G.B. Tran, and my book, Beat America, just recently came out, and it's basically the story about my family, specifically my mother and father, during the war, and basically how they survived it, how they got out, how they wound up in the States, told in the context of me discovering their stories for the first time in my 20s, like just after growing up as a snotty kid, not really interested in what happened to them. Finally realizing that it was really important to not only know what happened to them, but to also record it before the stories passed with them, and it was too late to share with other people. So.
Hi, I'm Zach Warden. I just had a book come out called The Klondike, which is a historical narrative of the Gold Rush, not focusing on one person, but rather the dozens of people that were actually key players in the Gold Rush. And basically, it's the setting is the main character, is basically what it gets down to.
Right, so we're going to talk about a few different things up here. And then about halfway through, we'll open it up for questions. But if you are moved by the spirit beforehand and really want to ask something, just raise your hand and we'll get to you in prompt order. So I thought we'd just talk about some of the issues of nonfiction comics and that are specific to each of your cases, and maybe some that are, you know, overlapping. We have quite the diverse group here with like histories of scientists, then autobio stories, then family histories. So I thought I'd start with GB down there. I was wondering if, when you're working on your book, you knew that the people that are represented in the book were going to be reading the book at some point, hopefully, unless they hate your work.
Yeah.
Did that affect how you wrote it?
Well, one of the earliest pieces of advice I got when working on the project was basically write as if everybody in it has been dead for 20 years. I could not do that because I spend Christmas with my parents and everybody in the book every year, so they are far from dead. Yeah, that was definitely an issue as far as how they were portrayed. And
the thing is that they're all, you're kind of warts and all here. No one's a saint in your book.
Well, I mean, that's reality, right? Like, there's no flat characters. Like, it was important for me to show the good and the bad of every person in the story, because mainly it's just basically around, focuses on my mom and dad, so there aren't too many tertiary characters and whatnot. But, yeah, I thought, like, the bad stuff made the good stuff seem greater, and the good stuff made the bad stuff seem deep, like, darker. And that's, to me, like, at least for a story's go, I feel like that's what makes a really good story that I find really appealing, is that covers a wide emotional range. And, like, I didn't want to paint my parents as very flat people, because it basically chronicles their entire life from childhood to adulthood, and they went through some crazy shit, and that basically, like, it's a range of things.
So you didn't leave anything out just because you're
all... Oh, I left a lot out.
Okay.
I mean, but the thing is, I didn't leave it out because I thought it was inappropriate. I left it out because I thought it didn't propel the story. Because, I mean, it's a 300-page book, but the thing is, like, what's in the book is maybe 30% of my total research, because I didn't want it to be a 1,000-page book that I worked on for 10 years. You know, I wanted it to be a smaller, tighter project, because... Another great advice that I got before I started was basically tell the smallest story possible. And even that turned out to be like this 300-page, you know, monkey on my shoulder. So.
Who gave you this advice? That's fantastic advice. Like, both these pieces of advice are amazing, and I wish people had given that to me.
I think it's really important to not paint people in books with a hero brush. Mm. I think it's really important.
All the people in your book have been dead for 100 years, though. So.
No, I know, but I mean, look at, you know, what Chester has done with himself. I mean, even what he did with Louis Riel, there was no hero brush there. I mean, he portrayed him as, like, a disturbed man.
So did you have any troubles when you were working on your books of, like,
oh, yeah,
perceived reactions, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I hear that this might go on the internet, so I can't say too much.
you're living the question I'm asking.
I am living the question you asked me. Spoiler alert, I'm currently working on trying to find out. My grandfather died in an accident in the 70s in Belfast, Northern Ireland, and I found out about that more so on a trip to Northern Ireland I went on about a month ago, and I've all of a sudden had this huge intention to start working on that as a book. But even as I sort of went, I want to get the autopsy report, and I want to get all these reports about what happened to him, already I'm getting shit from my family about, like, are you sure you really want to look into that? I'm like, yeah. Yeah, I do. That was horrible. How did this happen? And in my book, there's been a lot of you know, I had a really mean teacher, and she smacked us around a little bit, and I get a lot of people coming up to me and going, oh, she was such a terrible person. And, you know, if I ever meet that teacher, I'm going to punch her in the face. And I'm kind of like, she had cancer on her pituitary gland when this happened. And, you know, I met her years later when she was going through chemo and just before she died. And I've come to peace with it. And I guess I didn't really sum that up nicely in the book, because instead of painting something with a hero brush, I made her out to be a complete demon. And she wasn't. She was a person who didn't behave very well, but... Yeah, I'm not sure. I totally tangented there. I don't know if that answered your question
at all.
No,
that's good.
But, yeah.
Jim, I was wondering if you could maybe do a variation on this question about, like... Because sometimes you're writing about people who've been dead for a long time, and sometimes you're writing about people who are still alive. And I'm wondering if... your attitudes when you're writing it, you can feel like the difference knowing that, like, you know, Jane Goodall or someone's going to read your book.
Yeah. I got an interesting phone call about 6 months after the book Dignifying Science came out, which was about women scientists. And it was a very soft-spoken woman on the phone calling me up, mispronouncing my name, but everybody does that, so that's not news. And said, "This is Dr. Baruti Galdikas." And my knees went a little weak, and I sat down, even though I was already sitting down. I didn't know you could sit down hard, even though you're already sitting down. But I did that when I heard her say that. And then the next thing she said is, "I really liked the book." And that's when I fell down. And so it worked out okay. But yeah, knowing that people who are around could still... be reading the book. I mean, Mark Twain's autobiography is finally being published now, 100 years after his death, per his request. So far, I've read in there nothing that I wouldn't have put in while everybody was still alive, but I'm not Mark Twain, and I haven't read the whole book yet. But there are still family members alive, and there are still, and most of these people are vital in many ways in society. If you consider scientists part of society. And so they do still live on, and so you do wonder what folks are thinking. I think Leland Merrick, who did the art for the new Feynman book, summed it up very nicely in a series of blog posts he put up while he was doing the book. And he just showed a picture of himself drawing at the table, and then me standing over his shoulders, looking like this, as you know, as he changed things, and then Callista, our editor, and then Richard Feynman, and then Feynman's family, and then his wife, you know, all this stuff. I think everybody does that. And it's a question that came up at last night's conversation with Chris Ware, Seth, Adrian Tomine, and Chester Brown. And the freedom that you get from working with dead people, like Bruce Willis, I'll stop talking now. There's a great deal of freedom, but it's never complete freedom anyway. And so I think those people and their legacies, because they mean something to you, otherwise you wouldn't be spending all this time writing the book anyway or drawing the book anyway, always does affect you. But the challenge is, as GB said, and is to not flatten them.
So, David, I wanted to ask you maybe a variation on this as well, because I felt like with reading your book that while this experience was happening, you knew that someday you'd turn this into a book. And I was wondering if...
I wasn't sure if I'd ever actually get it done. I wasn't sure if it would actually ever be published. So
you didn't find...
I've learned... I've been doing this for a long time, like 20 years, and... You know, who's that that said once the family has a writer in their family, like the family's dead? You know, it's like my Aunt Muriel still won't talk to me because of a book I did about my grandfather, and my sister won't talk to me. She hates me. You know, and it's like, you know, I've put people in my books and it's been bad. So this whole thing with the military is like a family, the military, and I thought, oh man. You know, people are going to kill me for this. You know,
their family that won't talk to you.
And there's a family with weapons, too. So I'm going out on the range next weekend with my unit, and I have to do my yearly qualification as a marksman. So, no, but I was really surprised, you know, that these guys were like, hey, you know, Afghanistan veterans, like, people are really tougher than me and had done more than me. They were like, hey, you done good, you know, and like, hey, Sketch, they call me Etch a Sketch in the military. Hey, Etch, you done really good, you know. So I was really surprised. So you never know what to expect, people's reaction. So, you know, I was really scared to publish this book, and then it worked out so far. You know.
Yeah. Well, I was just wondering, like, you know, Tori and I were on an autobio panel last year, and we talked about this, how doing an autobiographical stories, and if you do a series of them and you know you're going to probably do more, it sometimes affects your behavior. Like, maybe you do things, you're like, this is going to make a great panel in the comic. And you get hurt at one point in this story, your leg. And I'm wondering if, like, you're like, at some point, you're like, how long it took you to realize this is gonna, like, this is gonna be great for the story?
No, it was really bad. And I just wanted to get my sketchbook, you know, because I knew I was gonna be in hospital for a long time, and that's the only heroic scene in this book. It's like they're going to the hospital, and then like, oh, you don't have your OHIP card, so you gotta go back to your tent and go through your stuff. But I had to get my sketchbook because I knew I was gonna be, incapacitated for a long time. But yeah, comics can keep you alive. Like, there's the guy in World War II, Ronald Searle. He was a combat engineer, and he was in a Japanese prison camp. And conditions are so bad that he couldn't even walk. They were all starving to death. But he put out this like daily comic strip, eh? And he'd be like lying there, he's sick of dysentery, and you know, I think it kept him going, right? And these comics can really keep you going through a lot of bad things.
That is, I'm going to remember that one for when it's like, oh, I got a headache. I'll feel like a big one. So one of the big things that kind of, I think, I don't know, feels like an issue when you're dealing with nonfiction comics, or maybe nonfiction storytelling in general, is how true are things, you know, like how loyal are you to the truth when you're telling a story? Because it feels like, you know, Jim, when I just reread Bone Sharps recently, and you have a whole section in the back
about where I lied.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's just all about like all the things that you flubbed or you moved around and stuff. And I was like, how much license do you give yourself when you're putting together a story to make stuff up or change facts?
I think you never want to change facts because they're already out there and people will call you on it as they should call you on it. But I've actually been thinking about this, and I think it's a good question. I'm going to be on a panel at the American Library Association in a month or so with a bunch of fiction writers. And I think the reason I don't know the reason I'm on the panel. They're all famous and I'm not. And they're all fiction writers and prose, and I write nonfiction comics. But I think the tie-in is that with science fiction, what they do is add in just enough science to propel the story along in the ways that they want and need it to go. And for the type of thing that I try to do, I need to do the converse of that. Add in just enough fiction to propel the story along in the direction it needs to go. And where you decide to leave things out, or where you put things in or place different emphases on it, on things that might not be literally true, at least the goal for me anyway, and this sounds really weird in the context of science, but to make those bits that are fictionalized emotionally true so that the feeling is accurate, even if we reworked this setting so that a few different people were in the room, even though they would have been in the room for the next panel that we're all on, if you know what I mean. Just because that would serve things. So people were at a panel, they listened to all of us speak about what we're doing, but we merged and morphed things and thus fictionalized things just enough to keep a story going. Because straight-up facts don't typically make for a particularly good story. Feynman is actually kind of a nice exception to that because he worked so hard to make his life a series of interesting anecdotes that I felt absolutely no shame at all in stringing together anecdotes and doing a little bit of fictionalizing, because that's what, what would Feynman do? You know, the little bracelet that you might wear, WWFD, and he would do that. So so I was fortunate with that character. Anyway, I think I also went off on a tangent.
No.
Tangents are fantastic.
Zach, I was going to ask you the kind of the same question. I mean, it feels like a lot of the things in your book, well, like from conversations, you know, that weren't recorded or something, there's a lot of stuff you had to make up, and I was wondering how you balanced the...
Well, I obviously call mine historical fiction just because of the fact that there's no narration, it's all just conversations, but I had to make it all up. How did I balance that?
Were there any times where you were like, you know, like you had some dates and stuff, and you're like, this doesn't work for my story? Like, this person isn't here?
No, I was kind of lucky in the fact that, I mean, I read a lot of books about it, and everything sort of just, like, fell into place as I was writing it. So I didn't really have a lot of problems balancing. But I also had to deal, like, I cut out a lot of stuff. Like, there was a lot of sort of, like, more comedic moments and characters that just would have totally taken away from the tone of the book. So I had to be very careful about what I put in and what I took out. So it made sense to me while I was doing it.
So there are gems out there.
There's a lot of stuff that I. I mean, if I had put
director's cut.
Yeah, it would have been like 800 pages. As it stands, I cut out 100 pages from the book. Yeah, just because I didn't want it to take me 7 years rather than 5.
Now, as the artist of the book as well, do you have any struggles with like fictionalization of how people looked? I mean,
I had a lot of problems actually. I spent the last year editing the book, mainly just the illustrations. A few of the characters look too similar just because everyone had mustaches and wore suits and hats. So I had to go back and actually like redraw about 40 pages of the book and entirely redesign certain characters. So that was definitely not fun.
Now, Tori, we were talking, I was talking with some people earlier about how even things that aren't history, it's like, you know, that your own history. Sometimes you just, like, your memory is fuzzy. I was wondering how...
Yeah.
How truthful are you?
I think this is just a prop for me. Like, I just like, oh, God. Okay. Hello. I tried really hard to only tell the truth in it. Like, and the truth. But... a lot of it in my story is taking place when I was a really small child, and what you remember as a small child and what actually happened are often similar, like how purple and pink are kind of similar, but they're not really the same color. And so there was a lot of things where I would write things, and then I showed it to a couple of my friends and who say were in class with me and would be like, yeah, she actually didn't hit Noah. She hit this other kid and stuff like that. And I'm like, oh, okay, that's not how I remember it. And things like that. But I tried really hard to stay true to it. But if I was writing it again now, I think I would prefer to keep with the spirit than with the actual order of events and with the actual thing. Like, I would rather try to express the point. Like, what's the point that you're trying to say? And if the point you're trying to say is that, you know, this happened to me, or this is what happened to me, and this is what I'm trying to communicate, the order of events and who was in the room and what room this was in and what grade you were in isn't the point. The point is that this happened and you learnt this wonderful moral from it, and that's the point. And so how I handled it when I wrote the book and how I would handle it now and in future works are different.
And David, you said you've been at this like a long time. Have you...
Yeah, I used to come to this library as a kid, you know, in 1977. Before that, I went to the Toronto Reference Library on College Street, and I'd look up caricature. I couldn't really spell it that well, but they had card catalogs, and it was, like, dirty on the top. You could see, like, you know, it was amazing. And, yeah, I learned a lot hanging around this place, this library, so it's really weird to come here and see this.
So, like, and, over the course of you doing all these comics, have you ever been called out on facts and then found out you were actually wrong?
Yeah. So, but, you know, everything can't be true. You know, like, I think Raymond Carver said, you know, like, if you set up a microphone at a checkout at Walmart, it would just, you know, it'd be true, but it'd be just like, you know, thank you, have a nice day, thank you, have a nice day, you know, 11:35 you change, thank you, you know. Yeah, I think of myself as an artist, like, you know, and if you read, like, art books, you know, okay, you are the artist, you control the picture, if you don't like that tree over there, you move it, right? So, yeah, you gotta be in charge of it. So, that's kind of what makes my book unique, because when you're in the army, you have no control over your life, right? So, that's probably the weird thing about it. You know, because I think most cartoonists and graphic novelists are just, to get the work done, you have to be so focused. Like, this book, this guy did, G.B. Tran, you know, holy cow, you know? Like, how did it, I can't believe he did that, you know, it's just so, such a big body of work, and the color, and all the research, and the art, you know, like, you must, like, just work 24 hours a day, right?
Yeah, how much work do you?
On comics, or my day job? Well, for this project, I was fortunate enough to actually be able to turn down to take a sabbatical, shall we say, from my day job for about 2.5 years to work on this full time. So it's like, you know, 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, and an extremely patient wife. So, but
were you, like, when you went home for Christmas, were you like, I'm sick of you people?
yeah, I've been drawing them nonstop.
No, it's, how dare you change your hairstyle?
Yeah, exactly. No, not at all. I mean, they were, whenever we got together for families, and this is very tangential, so I won't be on too long, but basically I just work during family reunions, and they just watch me work, basically. But what I wanted to comment on what Tori was saying earlier was that, the thing is, the thing about truth is, like, I don't know about you guys, but in my situation working on this, like, the thing I quickly learned, like, there's no truth, basically, because I'm dealing with historical events in my family that half the people involved in them are dead, and the other half that are alive, basically, each one have their own has their own interpretation of it. So as soon, like, the quicker I realized that there is no truth, the easier the story, like, building the story became, because it was just like, okay, well, it's great that I have all these facts and whatnot, but now let's make it a little bit, to fictionalize it, not in the sense of lying or anything like you were talking about earlier, but to make it, you know, hopefully a good story, because that's, at heart, that's what it needs to be. It has to be a good story, right? Like, when they were talking last night, Ware and all those guys, about the guys who were doing fiction stuff, but still it's a little nonfiction because their fiction characters are based on their own self. I think the same has to go in the other way, where nonfiction has to be fiction. Because if you don't, then you might just get bogged down in the facts and the details, and so lose sight of the fact that ultimately you're trying to make something that can resonate with the reader in an emotional level or some way whatsoever. You know, so which what you were talking about earlier, which I totally agree with, is like the emotional truth of it. Like, you know, not so much like the physical truth of it. I mean, as long as you're not lying, obviously. But like the emotional truth, I think, is far more important to hopefully relay to the reader than, you know, all the other stuff. So
maybe I can ask you the question I was trying to get at earlier with some other people about the when they draw about people who are alive. But I was wondering about if you've had any kind of reaction to your book about your views of, like, you know, Zach was talking about how, you know, setting was a character. Definitely in your book, setting is a character. And I was wondering if you've had any reaction to how you portray Vietnam. I mean, at times you're harsh to all sides at times. I mean,
yeah, I guess in my attempts to be objective, I just came down, painted everybody with a negative brush. Yeah. No, I mean, I definitely didn't want this to be a project about my feelings about the war, the repercussions of it, because, I mean, that's one of the things I quickly learned talking to various family members was, like, everybody, like, everybody in this story and every decision they made thinking they were in the right. And that includes my grandfather, who abandoned his father to fight for the North against my uncle, who was drafted in the South. Like, everybody was... So there wasn't so much as what's right and wrong, like what's pro, what's con. It's just basically the story of this family and what happened. And yeah, the setting does take a large... play a huge component of that. But I haven't gotten any flack yet, definitely.
I think that's a real powerful part in the book when you... Because you talk about your grandfather a lot, and then finally you tell his story.
Yeah.
And it's just like... And it's really powerful, but it's also like...
Please visit Bookends. The store for used
books. Please do.
Oh, awesome.
Let's go. Let's all go.
The store is open on Tuesdays, Fridays, and Saturdays from noon to 5 p.m. And Wednesdays and Thursdays from noon to 8 p.m.
I feel stupid talking over this. But, all right. So, your grandfather. So, but the only thing is...
Obviously shopping at Bookend.
Yeah. It's open to 5. Yes. He, in a lot of ways, he's the, like... The whole way through the book, I was. It felt like a lot of people were just folks. You know, they were just trying to get through life. You know, he seemed like the first one who like took a side. You know, like even your uncle who joined, he was drafted. You know, right. So it was very powerful from like having him be talked about the whole book. But then it's also all of a sudden you're hearing whatever the North side, yeah. All of a sudden, and it's
I felt that was required near the end. Well, it was placed near the end of the book. Sorry, this isn't really a spoiler, because the book, I mean, the role of my grandfather is introduced very early on in the book, and you're right, like, he's just kind of referred to through the first, like, four, fifth, sixth, you know, majority of the book, and then only in the end, after you get everybody else's experience, do you see his experience to kind of help, to not only provide, like, the other side of the coin, but also to be, like, I mean, I guess this is kind of a spoiler, but the way he's painted in the book is kind of like a villain. And then went to reveal his story to be like, look, all these decisions he made, like, there was a reason, and his heart was in it, and he's just as upset as everybody else about how everything turned out. So.
So, wow, time flies when you have so many awesome people on your panel. So, yeah, we only have about, let's see, is it 2:15? So we only have about 15 minutes left. Do we have any questions? Right there.
Yeah, I noticed some comments earlier related to this, and I read some blog posts about it recently, although I can't remember which blog, about sort of trend in independent comics, particularly biographical or autobiographical, to sort of tell more heroic and less self-deprecating stories. Something about how, like, you know, started with American Splendor and stuff like that, and then all the imitators, they sort of are more promotional and self-promotional and stuff like that. And, I agree that it's a bad thing, and if you especially want to get the truth. But do you guys think that there's almost like a danger in going almost the other, too much the other way? Like, if everything has to be self-deprecating to be cool, are you losing some subtlety of the real stories there, or like losing sincere positive messages that could be, you know, told in this stuff?
Well, my issue is that I'm not cool, so it's hard to draw comics where I am. I'd really love to. That'd be amazing, but. It's hard when you basically just sit in your house to read comics all day. It's hard to sort of make yourself sound awesome. But I have noticed in a lot of, like, autobio comics I read on the internet and stuff, people draw themselves looking really fit. And I'm sort of going, I bet you're a little chubby. And, like, I've caught myself doing it where, like, I draw myself with, like, really nice hair. I'm sort of going, that's a lie. But I'm okay with it. Whatever, I'm drawing it. I can draw, and I can draw without drawing the pimples and stuff. It's great. It's a wonderful brush of making yourself look awesome.
Those are pimples.
Oh, thank you. Makeup, it's amazing.
Great skin.
Oh, yeah. This is a great panel. I'm having so much fun. but yeah, it's hard because you kind of want to write self-deprecating comics because they're more fun, and you can sort of, I find, anyway, I don't know. I like writing ones where it's like, yeah, and I couldn't find any toilet paper. Ba-dum-ba-ba.
So you got to answer this, because you make yourself out to be a bit of a brat in your book.
Oh, do? I thought I was an angel. Yeah, I'm kind of an a-hole in the book. But that's basically, quickly to answer that question, is basically because I felt, every kid, all of us, if you have a parent, if you don't think you went through a period in your life where you were a total a-hole to your parents, then you're completely delusional. And I just wanted to get that out in the book form because that sets up the conflict of, like, my journey to basically embrace the heritage and their story. Like, that creates the character arc for me. But what you were saying earlier about the, you know, self-deprecating, I'm wondering if that's a little bit because, like, when you're trying to draw, like, tell humorous situations, it's a lot easier to be self-deprecating because you're making fun of yourself and you don't have to worry about offending anybody. Like, if you apply the same situation to somebody else and be like, oh, well, maybe they won't like how I depicted them.
Oh, but, yeah, I do that to Keen all the time. But yeah. we're writing, my boyfriend and I have written a travel diary. We went to Italy together over the summer. And so we're drawing each other, and I now come off as just the biggest bitch of all time. Like, every time he draws me, I'm, like, glaring, and my friend read it, she's laughing, but, like, I just come off as I'm just yelling at him the entire time, and then I've drawn him as just being completely dumb the entire time. And it's to the point that we put out the mini, and now we're going, could you just maybe soften the eyebrows a little, because I'm kind of horrible. But yeah, it's kind of, and then you just get competitively mean.
I feel like it's a lot funnier for me to make fun of myself than for me to make fun of my sister.
Yes.
You
know? So. Well, I don't know. Is your sister funny?
One of my family's funny. This is not a laugh riot.
Yeah. So I have to admit, I didn't chuckle.
It's a couple moments. Yeah.
David, how about you? Do you ever feel like you're maybe...
Well,
you too self-deprecating.
I guess the point of all this is to pass on wisdom and all the mistakes that you've made in your life. You kind of, you know, want other people not to make them. So, you know, don't screw your best friend's girlfriend. You know, like, just basic stuff. And, you know.
That's good advice.
Sounds great. Yeah, take that with you. So I wanted to ask a question about research. Maybe we can start with Zach down at the end. Do you love it? Were you great in school? Were you like, I love researching stuff? And
I was not a good student, but I always got really good grades when I wrote essays. So the research was a lot of fun to me. I loved doing it. I spent probably 4 of the 5 years working on this book, researching. And then when I was editing, going back and researching some more. So I loved it.
Jim?
Do you love research? Your life is research.
Yeah, it is. GB, would you like to answer for me?
No, no.
Okay. Yeah, I love it.
This guy lives for research.
I pretty much live for research. It's a great way of avoiding writing, for one thing. I mean, there's always one more book to read about the subject, and even though you know you're not going to use any of it, you still get to read it if you want. I just finished working on a 13-page story for which I read, like, 6 books, and I didn't need to, but I couldn't stop. So.
Even Roehampton Mystery says, I think you have to read, like, 7 hours for every 1 hour you write as a writer.
Never heard that. That's interesting.
Yeah. Now, your books are full of, like, little bits of research here and there. Do you find yourself, like...
Yeah, I'm just full of useless facts. You know, even
the history of jump roping was sort of...
10 years old, I was, like, reading all these... Remember Trivia was really big? I was, like, really into that in grade 4. So...
Any more questions from the audience? Got about 5 minutes left.
Do any of you guys do interviews? Do you sit down with your family? Do you need any and actually just have a set time when you're asking questions, or are you mostly just absorbing?
Yeah, all the research for my book was strictly face to face or phone interviews.
Yeah.
So that was fun. Transcribing the interviews, not so much fun because they were in Vietnamese and my Vietnamese is very poor. So once I listened to the recording, like, the next day, I didn't understand, like, half the things I was spoken about. So, but yeah, no, it's all face to face. None of it was book research. I mean, a little bit of book research to find, like, main events during the war during the same timeline as my parents' timeline. But that was also like the challenging part, because at what point do you say enough is enough? Like in my situation, because, you know, after hearing the, you know, the billionth version of the same story from the, you know, millionth family member, it's like I reached the point where I had to basically say, look, I do feel like I have enough to form a complete story now, even though, well knowing that there is still so many other, you know, variations out there. So that was, you know, and only at the point where I reached that was I actually able to start illustrating it.
So. Okay, so that was going to be my follow-up there. Are they sitting for their portraits while you're...
No. As far as visually depicting everybody, I didn't really make them look... I wasn't concerned about making them look the way they look like in real life, because part of it is just my visual aesthetic. It's not that detailed. But also, for the other sense of where I really tried to make the characters as distinct as possible, whether it's a certain way they carry themselves, or they walk, or the way they dress, or something like that. So, I mean, I think that was a little disappointment, because, like, my first reaction, really the only reaction, negative reaction I got from my mom was basically her complaining that I didn't draw her beautiful enough.
So. But you got those photos of her. Yes. I don't want to be a creep, but she was a very attractive young woman.
No. Everybody sees the photos is like, man, your mom's hot. Yeah, I'm like, yeah, she was a stud. There's one page in the entire book that's actually just photographs, and it happens at a certain point that hopefully makes sense.
Bikinis. All right. Jim, do you do original, is that what they call it, original research when you interview?
I think the technical term is using primary sources and or, you know, direct to interviews. You can't get more of a primary source than that. And so, yeah, you do it whenever you can, and it's not always possible, but there are, you know, library archives. I've been to Feynman's archives in Caltech, and I've been to Leo Szilard's archives in San Diego. The only time I ever spent time after the San Diego convention, like being not in the convention center, I went straight to the basement of a library. It's just pathetic.
One basement to another.
But yeah, pretty much. But when you can talk to people, it's really cool, and I've had some really wonderful good luck with the book about the space race. You know, an hour conversation with Buzz Aldrin. That was a good day. I've still got a phone message that I've never been able to bear deleting from Al Bean, the lunar module pilot for Apollo 12. And one night, late at night, I don't know who to thank for this, but it looked like spam, but I was probably avoiding writing, so I was reading any email. Even the ones from Nigeria. I was reading all the email that came in, and it came from this very bogus-looking email address, and it had your books as the subject line. But it did start, "Dear Mr. Ottaviani, I was traveling, so I didn't see your books immediately, but to answer your questions about Apollo 11, la 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 la, you're sincerely Neil Armstrong." And I yelled a very bad curse word. It was late at night, and my wife ran in from the back porch and said, "What? I just... look at that." She goes, "Oh, Neil Armstrong, I just wrote you an email." So, yeah, there are benefits to doing nonfiction.
Now, did that make you want to, like, go back and rewrite the book because, like, you had these new facts, or?
No, it didn't. I was early enough on in the process that it came when it needed to come. So that was double good luck.
All right, so we're almost out of time. We have one last question.
Yeah, in terms of doing a biographical story of someone who's still alive, is there a point between the script process and the art process? Do you give your subject ever any, say, input or critique?
I think this only applies to you, Jim.
Well, yeah. It could apply to GB. Do you allow yourself input about yourselves?
Did you let people read it before it was released on the world?
I did.
Bad idea.
Yeah, it was a bad idea.
I think it's in general a bad idea too. I offer, but no, the folks that I write about are busy doing other things, typically.
Am I the only one that was glad that I showed my family and my parents there beforehand?
Well, but it's your family.
Yeah,
I think that's
yeah.
very that's that's why I was interested in Tori and David as well.
My parents were surprised by my book, and when I handed it to her, my mom was like, well, you need to write in, like, all these other things. And my mom wanted, like, an extra 20 pages in the book about her struggle, which was really cool. Well, not really, but, like, just I'm exaggerating. But she just wanted me to put more stuff in about, you know, what it is. And I was kind of like, I just kind of want to finish the book now. So I shouldn't have.
David, do you let people read your books before they presented to the world? People in the world?
No, because... like, I did this one about David Milgaard, and he was, you know, he was into it at first, and then he's like, oh, I'm going to shut you down, man, and, like, he's just like, I guess some people think comics are, like, Archie comics, or you're making fun, like, they think comics are making fun, right? And I don't think I'm really making fun of people, but, you know, a lot of people just want to shut you down, and you got to fight on.
All right, so it looks like we're out of time. So GB, Jim, and Tori all have their own tables. GB and Jim are here on the first floor. Tori's up. Are you going to be signing it first, second?
Drawing
quarterly, sorry.
Yes.
So Zach will be at drawing quarterly. Are you going to be signing it?
I'm going to go to the Doug Wright table. I got a lot of room there. Nobody's there.
All right, so it'll be the Doug Wright. Thank you all for coming.
Thanks
to our panelists.
Thank you.